According to an article that was put out this week by the New York Times, he was compared to Jay Gatsby, Citizen Kane, and Walt Disney. But he was his own production. Okay? He repeatedly likened his life to a romantic movie. It starred an ageless, sophisticated, in silk pajamas and a smoking jacket, hosting a never-ending party for famous and fascinating people. They were referencing Hugh Hefner, okay? The self-proclaimed playboy and trailblazer of the pornographic empire that is eating away at our society like a cancer. He died this past week, if you didn't see the headlines. In the words of another columnist, the arc of his life vindicated his moral critics, conservative and feminist. What began with talk of jazz and Picasso and other signifiers of good taste ended in sleazy decrepitude that would have been pitiable if it wasn't so exploitative. Early, Hef had a pipe and a suit and a highbrow reference for every occasion. He even claimed to have a philosophy, that final refuge of the scoundrel. But late Hef was a lecherous, lowbrow Peter Pan playing at perpetual boyhood. Ice cream for breakfast, pajamas all day, while bodyguards shooed male celebrities away from his paid harem, and the skull grinned beneath his papery skin. I wonder what was said at Hefner's funeral. I wonder, were there any scriptures that were read? You know, I wonder what the message was at the end of this man's life. It's very interesting, you know, even in this columnist speaks of his talk of jazz and Picasso. He was a fan of Nietzsche. He was a fan of these ideas that even eroded. You see minds like G.K. Chesterton talk about the depressing effect that the Impressionist painters had on him, because he realized that ultimately they were driving at meaninglessness. What does this mean? And I think it's that thread that Hugh Hefner pulled on, this meaningless. It's about me, it's about now, it's about hedonism. I, me, mine. I build my kingdom. I take from you at your expense for my benefit. And I wonder, with all the lives he's ruined, with all the families that are broken, who remembered Hef? What did they talk about at his funeral? I think if I was preaching this particular funeral, our text today would serve as an excellent text, a fitting memorial for a man such as Hugh Hefner. We're going to be in Daniel chapter 5 today. If you want to go ahead and turn there with me, we're going to look at a story about the writing on the wall. The writing on the wall. Saturday night, October 12th, 539 BC. A party was underway that would have made the Playboy Mansion seem tame, like a little frat party. But what the guests didn't know was that this was a going away party, right? Because tonight the Babylonian Empire is going away in a single night. In this chapter, chapter 5 of Daniel, we're given the eyewitness account of how in a single night the Medo-Persians come in and Babylon is completely destroyed. Their leadership, it's gone. Okay, so the setting of this chapter and all of chapter 5, we're looking at less than a 24-hour period. Okay, 12 hours tops. Okay, and if you recall Nebuchadnezzar's dream in chapter 2 when we were looking at that great statue, it represented four Gentile kingdoms that would rule over Israel until the Messiah would come and restore the kingdom to Israel. So it had the top section of that statue was a head of gold and it represented Babylon. When it was followed by a chest and arms of silver, represented Medo-Persia, the Medes and the Persians. Then you had these abs and thighs of bronze that represented Greece, and then legs of iron and feet of iron and clay that represented Rome. Four Gentile kingdoms that make up this time period, the times of the Gentiles. And in this chapter, we're going to witness the kingdom pass from the head of gold to the chest and arms of silver. Okay, we're watching this transition take place. And just as a reminder before we begin, remember, chapter 2 to chapter 7 in the book of Daniel is written in Aramaic. It is a unit. In fact, it's a unit that's going to mirror itself. It's what theologians will call a chiasm. Now, they'll find those things everywhere. I don't. But this one is intentional. You'll find that chapter 2 is going to mirror chapter 7. Chapter 3 mirrors chapter 6. Chapter 4 mirrors chapter 5. So if you remember last week, we were talking about Nebuchadnezzar and how he was humbled by the Lord, how he found out that it is the Lord who rules in the affairs of mankind and he bestows the kingdom on whom he wishes. And Nebuchadnezzar realized that by the end and honored God. He was out there telling everybody about his testimony, what the Lord has done for him. Now we're going to see what happens with one of his successors. His name is Belshazzar. Pick it up in Daniel chapter 5. Look at verse 1. Belshazzar, the king, held a great feast for 1,000 of his nobles. And he was drinking wine in the presence of the 1,000. And when Belshazzar tasted the wine, he gave orders to bring the gold and silver vessels which Nebuchadnezzar his father had taken out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem, so that the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines might drink from them. Then they brought the gold vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God, which was in Jerusalem. And the king and his nobles and his wives and his concubines drank from them. They drank the wine and praised the gods of gold and silver and bronze, iron, wood, and stone. In the previous four chapters, we were dealing with Nebuchadnezzar on the throne. We were watching the Nebuchadnezzar arc, you know, going from pagan to preacher. Okay? By the end of this last chapter, things were looking pretty good in chapter 4, right? You know, Nebuchadnezzar is an evangelist now, and he's telling everybody about the Jewish God. But in chapter 5, verse 1, look at verse 37 of Daniel 4. I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise, exalt, and honor the King of heaven. For all his works are true, his ways are just, he is able to humble those who walk in pride. And now, in chapter 5, verse 1, we're introduced to this guy named Belshazzar, and we are clearly theological miles away from Daniel chapter 4. Because this guy seems to think that it's a good idea to openly mock the one who humbled Nebuchadnezzar. So I ask, who in the world is this clown Belshazzar? Who is this guy? And I find it's been 23 years since Nebuchadnezzar has died. And there's been a few kings that have come and gone. You know, it's kind of an interesting little history lesson. You just have guys rise up and get assassinated, and you have revolts take place, just a few. It kind of reminds me of the Book of the Kings. You remember those quick sections where one guy in the northern kingdom of Israel, where they didn't have that Davidic line that was constantly sitting on the throne, and it was just like a free-for-all. You know, your dynasty may pop up for a minute, but it could be gone in a second. You know, some guys only ruled for like a month. So, it reminded me of that. A few kings come, pop up, but now, the person who's currently on the throne, the king, is married to Nebuchadnezzar's daughter. So, he's tried to bring back some legitimacy to the throne. And this king's name is Nabonidus. Nabonidus. But what's interesting is, Nabonidus doesn't really like hanging out in Babylon. He's got other things he likes to do. He likes to go out and hunt. He likes to go out and spend his time in Arabia. So what he does is he puts his oldest son in charge of the farm while he's gone. Okay? So he's kind of co-reigning for about a period of 14 years. Nabonidus puts his son Belshazzar on the throne, who would be Nebuchadnezzar's grandson. Okay? He's going to be referred to as, Nebuchadnezzar is going to be referred to as his father in this text. And the Hebrew and Aramaic did not have a word for grandfather. So they use this same term that we would use, the father, and it's legitimate. You say, well, Nebuchadnezzar was your father. They're trying to point back to what happened with Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 4. Okay? Now, his name is Belshazzar, which is a little confusing because Nebuchadnezzar named Daniel Belshazzar, right? Except it had that little addition in the text, that little T-E, Belshazzar. And we discussed that was probably added by Daniel writing this, because Belshazzar means may Bel protect the king. And there's speculation is what that little belt, that T-E means. People think it means not, like Bel cannot protect the king. So we have in our text, Belshazzar, may Bel protect the king, and then he's going to be dealing with Bel cannot protect the king, but most likely. So in our situation, Dad's not home. Junior's in charge of the house. And what does he decide to do? Well, he holds a great feast for all his nobles, and they're drinking wine in the presence. He's drinking in the presence of the thousand. You know, he says, "I'm going to throw a kegger. We're going to have this big drinking party. You know, I'm going to invite all my friends over, and we're going to have a good time." Or, in the words of the prophet Bon Jovi, you know, it's all the same. Only the names change. You know, the kids are doing the same thing back then that they do now. Parents are out of town, so the kids are going to play. What is that? The mice are away, or the cats are away, so the mice will play. Same thing. He's throwing a party. And I ask, why is he throwing this crazy party? What's the occasion? Well, the Medo-Persians have been chipping away at the Babylonian Empire for a little while now. Okay, this fellow named Cyrus is the king of, he's a Medo-Persian, he's a Mede and a Persian, and he's chipping away at their empire. And in fact, on October 10th, just 2 days earlier, he defeated Belshazzar's dad, Nabonidus, in battle. Okay? He says, "I'm coming for Babylon." Nabonidus says, "No, you're not. I'm going to go stop you." And then he gets whooped, so Nabonidus runs off. It's 2 days ago. So now all the people are fleeing to Babylon because Babylon has these excellent fortifications, and really that's the only place left that they have a stronghold. You know, the Medes and Persians have taken all their other territory. So they come and they're holed up in Babylon. They're trying to hide, and the Medo-Persians are coming, and they're laying up a siege. But what's interesting is, you know, Babylon is very prepared for a siege. They got enough food in the pantry for 20 years, according to one historian. Okay, not only that, the Euphrates River runs north to south through the city. They got water, they got food, they have incredible fortifications. I mean, the historians that talk about the size of their walls and the amount of towers, they say that their walls were 35 stories high, 350 feet high, which is an exaggeration, but nonetheless, we're expecting these massive, it just seems like an untakeable fortress. They're like doomsday preppers, right? They're doomsday preppers before that was cool, and they think that this city is impregnable. There's an ancient document called the Nabonidus Chronicle that records the attitude of the Babylonians on this night, and it says, "Mounting upon the battlements that crowned their walls, they insulted and jeered at Darius." Darius is the commander of this army that's coming against him. "They insulted and jeered at Darius and his mighty host. One even shouted to them and said, 'Why do you sit there, Persians? Why don't you go back to your homes? Till mules foal, you will not take our city.'" Till mules foal. And if anybody knows anything about mules, mules don't have kids. They can't give birth. But I hear it's because, you know, you got a horse and a donkey. One has, they end up with an odd number of chromosomes at the end. For some reason, with an odd number of chromosomes, you can't reproduce. So they're saying, "It's never going to happen. You're wasting your time. You can't overcome this." I think of the guys, any of y'all seen Monty Python, The Search for the Holy Grail? You know, you think of those French guys on the wall that are taunting them. You know, the king, King Arthur comes, they're looking for the Holy Grail. They say, "We've already got one. We're not interested." You know, or if you haven't seen that, I wouldn't recommend watching that one. You can go see the VeggieTales version is really good. It has the French peas. The French peas with the Battle of Jericho, and they're like, "Yeah, what do you guys do?" They're basically doing the same thing. You know, "You guys are going to throw a siege. We're going to throw a party, you know? We're not worried about this." And it's partly, I would imagine, an attempt at distraction, like a self-medication of sorts. You know, you got this massive city, but we're just surrounded by this army that wants to take us out. It's kind of distressing. Let's take our minds off our trouble for a while. Let's build morale. Let's throw a party, eat and drink, for tomorrow we die kind of idea. Let's enjoy the now. Hedonism. But problems we're going to find are going to arise quite quickly. Problems arise in verse 2, we see, when the king tasted the wine. Because, well, as we know, you know, for most of us, you know, a little alcohol is going to impair our judgment. But Belshazzar must have been a lightweight, because after he tasted the wine, his judgment appears to be graveyard dead. Okay? He's either drunk as a skunk or he's dumb as a brick, because he decides it's a good idea to have his people bring in the vessels which were captured from the temple in Jerusalem. From verse 3, he's going to say, it's from the house of God. You know, the God that humbled your grandfather, the great King Nebuchadnezzar, which you are not. Ezra, in chapter 1, gives an inventory of these items that were taken by Babylon. And it wasn't just like a couple of wine glasses, okay? It's a full temple set. He has 5,400 items. 5,400 items. So, it's not like this is not the king's attempt to break out the fine Jewish temple china. Okay, he's not saying this is a special occasion we're going to celebrate. Instead, he's taking something that has been set apart for special use, and he's going to use it in a common way. He's going to use it to, he's going to treat the vessels of the temple like they're red solo cups for his party. Okay? He's treating these holy things like they're disposable things. In a way, it's similar to Hugh Hefner. You know, he treats women like disposable things. Paul's going to say again and again, 2 Corinthians 4, Romans 9, human beings are the vessels of God. We were made for a holy use. You know, if you want to set yourself apart, you can set yourself apart for holy use. You're made in God's image. We shouldn't be treated as common. We are set apart for a special purpose, to serve, to represent God. Not to be used for our pleasures, for our fancies, at someone's expense for our benefit. And now, because we find this king has decided to make a mockery of the great God that humbled Nebuchadnezzar, well, somebody's going to crash the party. We're going to have a party crasher. Pick it up in verse 5. Suddenly, the fingers of a man's hand emerged and began writing opposite of the lampstand on the plaster of the king's palace. And the king saw the back of the hand that did the writing. And then the king's face grew pale, and his thoughts alarmed him, and his hip joints went slack, and his knees began knocking. And the king called aloud to bring the conjurers, the Chaldeans, the diviners. And the king spoke and said to the wise men of Babylon, any man who can read this inscription and explain its interpretation to me shall be clothed with purple and have a necklace of gold around his neck and have authority as third ruler in the kingdom. You know, this supernatural hand appears, writing graffiti on the wall. Belshazzar sobers up real quick. He sobers up real quick. His knees begin, according to the KJV, they're smoting together. And he's crying out loud. He's in a panic. There's writing on the wall. Everybody can see it. Nobody can read it. You know, something strange in the neighborhood in Babylon. Who are you going to call?
Daniel.
If you're smart. If you're smart, you're going to call Daniel. But before you think about that, who are you going to wake up in their pajamas? Oh, it's going to be those wise men. Those worthless wise men. I don't even know why. They're only around because Daniel has kept them around. We know that. He's going to call the wise men. He's going to bring them in their PJs. You know, they're going to rush to the Babylon Playboy Mansion. They're going to stroll in. He says, look, I will promote you. I will give you anything if you just do your job for once. If you can just do what you're supposed to do for me, I will make you third in the kingdom. That's interesting. Third in the kingdom. He says that because, again, this is the prince who is co-reigning with Nabonidus. So Nabonidus, the king, is first. Belshazzar is second. So you'll be right next in line. Third in the kingdom. You'll have riches, power, glory, honor. But we find they're as worthless as they always are. Verse 8. The king's wise men came in and they could not read the description or make known its interpretation to the king. So the king is upset. He's alarmed. He's perplexed. What can I do? And there's an individual that we realize has been forgotten in this kingdom. The one who's able to interpret dreams. The one who has a spirit of the holy God with him. They've forgotten. He's not in the position he once was. Somewhere in this transition of power, in the chaos of, from assassination and succession from one king to the next, Daniel is no longer sitting in that place where he was. But there's someone we'll find who remembers him. Look at it. In verse 10, the queen entered the banquet hall because of the words of the king and his nobles. And the queen spoke and said, "Oh, king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts alarm you or your face be pale. There's a man in your kingdom in whom is a spirit of," most likely the holy God, I think. "And in the days of your father," this is talking about his grandfather, Nebuchadnezzar, "illumination, insight, and wisdom like the wisdom of the gods was found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, appointed him chief of the magician, conjurers, Chaldeans, and diviners. This was because an extraordinary spirit of knowledge, insight, interpretation of dreams, explanation of enigmas," I mean, he can just solve whatever, "it's found in Daniel, whom the king named Belshazzar." "Let Daniel now be summoned, and he will declare the interpretation for you." So a queen appears who knows about Daniel. And I ask, who is the queen? Because I look back in verse 2 and find that, you know, Belshazzar is throwing a party that has himself, his nobles, his wives, and his concubines there. Not the queen, though. You know, they're already, his wives are with him when the queen entered. So I realize, well, no, the queen is not Belshazzar's wife. This is the queen mother. This is Nabonidus's wife. This is Nebuchadnezzar's daughter. And she knows all about what happened with her dad. She knows all about Daniel. She says, "I know someone who can solve your problem. I know someone who can help you." So it's nighttime o'clock, and Daniel's once again gets the call. He's needed now at the Babylon Playboy Mansion. He's escorted through the throne room. He's flanked by scantily clad women and intoxicated celebrities, each armed with their own party favor, you know, a vessel from the temple with their drink of choice. And Belshazzar offers Daniel this same deal as the wise men. "Give me the interpretation. I'll give you riches. I'll give you power. I'll make you third most powerful in the land." Verse 16. But notice Daniel's response. Verse 17. "Then Daniel answered, and he said before the king, 'Keep your gifts for yourself, or give your rewards to someone else. However, I will read the description to the king and make the interpretation known to him.'" He says, "You can keep your junk. Really not very interested in it." And we'll find that the position that he's offering is not going to be very valuable for very long, right? You know, all that Belshazzar and his entourage had spent their lives amassing, all this is going to disappear in the blink of an eye, in an instant. And that's something that the Bible repeats again and again and again. It's riches, money, power, status, this wealth, this opulence. It's transitory. It is vanity. It is a waste of your time to hoard up these things, in Solomon's word, because the next man is just going to come and take it from you. He's going to enjoy all your hard work. You won't enjoy it. You're gone. It's transitory. Like Nebuchadnezzar's dream, all of our kingdoms are just dust in the wind. They're not the final kingdom. But somehow, biblically at least, we see again and again, we seem to forget that, or we don't believe it, and we think, this time it's different. This time it will last. This kingdom will not be replaced. My kingdom will last. And then history repeats itself. And what I find is that we need a history lesson. You know, we got to know the past, so I'm not doomed to repeat it. I got to know the past so I don't fall into that same trap. So God is going to use Daniel here to give Belshazzar a history lesson. And then he's going to give him a theology lesson. And then he's going to give him a spelling lesson. So pick it up. Notice it. Verse 18. "O king, the Most High God granted sovereignty, grandeur, glory, majesty to Nebuchadnezzar, your father. Because of the grandeur which he bestowed on him, all the peoples, nations, men of every language, they feared, they trembled before him. Whoever he wished, he killed. And whomever he wished, he spared alive. And whomever he wished, he elevated. Whomever he wished, he humbled. But when his heart was lifted up, and his spirit became so proud that he behaved arrogantly, he was deposed from his royal throne. And his glory was taken away from him. He was also driven away from mankind, and his heart was made like that of beasts, and his dwelling place was with the wild donkeys. He was given grass to eat like cattle, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven until he recognized that the Most High God is ruler over the realm of mankind, and he sets it over whomever he wishes. He says, okay, somehow you obviously haven't heard this, but your grandfather, the one who was the greatest ruler your kingdom ever had, who did whatever he wished, whom the Medes and the Persians and Greece, everyone feared him, whose word was sovereign. You know, his problem was, you know where he got into trouble? He started acting arrogantly against the God of Israel. You look around, you see all these little temple vessels around and people are drinking. Yeah, he got arrogant, and then that God to whom the dominion belongs decided to take it from Nebuchadnezzar. And you know what your dad did? Well, first he went out into the field and he grazed on grass like an animal for 7 years until the Most High was satisfied. And then, when he was willing to recognize his mistake, then he returned to the kingdom. Now, how do you think this is going to go for you? Well, he's going to tell him. He's going to make it plain. Notice his theology lesson. Verse 22. Yet you, his son, Belshazzar, may Bel protect the king, you have not humbled your heart, even though you knew all this. You knew this. But you have exalted yourself against the Lord of heaven, and they have brought the vessels of his house before you, and you and your nobles, your wives, your concubines have been drinking wine from them and have praised the gods of silver, gold, bronze, iron, wood, stone, gods which do not see, hear, or understand. But the God in whose hand are your life and breath and all your ways, that God you have not glorified. You've made a mistake. You've looked around and honored the wrong thing. You've misplaced where your security is at. It's not in these fortifications. It's not in your gold. It's not in the nobles. Your security lays in the palm of the hand of the God whom you are mocking. You've made a mistake. And for that, you're going to get a spelling lesson. Notice it. Here's the inscription. Verse 25. What was written out is this. Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. Now, I used to think that the old Hebrew and Aramaic text had just no spaces at all. So it's like, man, how do you, you know, first of all, they're all consonants. There's no vowels in the original Hebrew and Aramaic. So it's like, if they were all crunched together, I was thinking, you know, how in the world would anybody ever make sense of this? But it turns out that's not the case. It did happen. There was times where you'd get a scroll that was bunched together because you got to remember, these things are expensive. So if you're a scribe and you're trying to, like, you know, fit it all in there and save some cash, you may crunch that text together. But that was not the normal way to do it. The normal was to make spaces. So you at least had words, you know, spaces between the words. You knew where the divisions were, but you didn't have vowels. And that's problematic. Think of our own language, all right? If you don't have context to interpret a word, you don't know where to land the field of meaning. So if I were to say something like, a big gray trunk, well, without context, you don't really know where to land that, do you? I could be talking about an elephant trunk. I could be talking about a car trunk. I could be talking about a chest. I could be talking about a tree trunk. You need context to sit that in to understand which way to take the field of meaning that these words sit in. Well, when you don't even have vowels, that problem gets much worse. Okay? You need the context, unless you're Daniel. You need the context or you need an inspired interpreter. Okay? And that's what he gets. Daniel says that this means mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. When we're talking about mene, it is a term we're thinking of a mina. A mina is 50 shekels, and the word itself means something like to number, to count. Count, count. Tekel, also a word that has Hebrew roots. We're thinking of a shekel here, tekel. And it can mean to weigh. So we have count, count or number, weigh, and then this word, a parson. Half a shekel. So a mina, 50 shekels, tekel, a shekel, and then a parson, half a shekel, which can simply mean to divide. So he's saying that it means numbered, weighed, divided. And I ask, well, what in the world does that mean? Even if you were able, if I'm the interpreter, if I'm the wise man, the Chaldeans, I don't really have a shot of getting, to mene, tekel, a parson, but even if I got there, I don't have the context to work with. I think that's the issue. You'll hear, there's Jewish tradition that says it was written, up and down is why they couldn't understand. I don't think that has anything to do with it. I mean, the fact of the matter is, without context, you can't make heads or tails of this. But Daniel knows, because he has the Spirit of the Lord within him that reveals interpretations, visions, dreams, enigmas. And this is what he says. Verse 26. This is the interpretation of the message. Mene, God has numbered your kingdom and put an end to it. Tekel, you have been weighed on the scales and found deficient. Perez, your kingdom has been divided and given over to the Medes and the Persians. He says, Dr. Hitchcock will say it this way, I really appreciate it. Your number's up. You don't measure up, you're going to be divided up. Okay? Your time is up. Now, you may have noticed the difference there. Verse 28, Perez, where in verse 25 he's saying, well, the inscription says, Mene, mene, tekel, a parson. Well, he translates mene, verse 26, verse 27. He translates tekel, verse 28. It's Perez. So I'm saying, well, what's going on here? And a parson is the same word as Perez. Now, the U is an and, basically, on the front. That's saying and. This, and that. But Perez speaks of a completed action. It's something that's already taken place, whereas a parson is the present tense of it. Present tense, okay, you're being divided, you were divided. Okay, so he's moving from present tense to past tense. It's certain. This is done. It's not open for discussion. You're not getting 7 years in the grassy plain to figure this out. It's over, like now. And what's also interesting, Perez, what consonants would we be working with Perez? P-R-S. So some will also take this, it's the same consonants if he's trying to talk about Persia, that not only is your kingdom being divided up, it's going to be Persianized. You're getting Persianized tonight. It's going to be given away. You, along with everything else, you have that 20 years of food you stored up, it's not going to do you much good. It's going to do them good. By the way, that was one of the curses on Israel, if you remember. The blessing was, they'll move into their land and they'll live in houses they didn't build. They'll work land that they didn't plant. Right? But the curse is, you reject the Lord, enemies are going to come in. They're going to live in the houses that you built. They're going to eat your food. They're going to eat your crops. They're going to take your cattle. We see it happening here to Belshazzar. The head of gold is going to be replaced less than 60 years after this was prophesied. But you know what else is more amazing to me? I want you to look at this with me, and we're going to notice how the story ends. Don't lose your place in Daniel, because we're going to finish there. But if you would, just turn with me briefly to Jeremiah 50. There are all kinds of interesting chapters that talk about the demise of Babylon. In fact, Isaiah 45 is an interesting chapter, because the Lord will name Cyrus the Persian by name. Isaiah was written way before this took place. He named Cyrus the Persian and calls him his Messiah, which in that context is not having the theological context of the one who's going to come and rule ultimately for God. It's this one that God is using for a special service. So any king can be a Messiah in that sense, but not the ultimate seed of the woman. But nonetheless, look at this. I want to look at first Jeremiah 50, and then we're going to look at 51. Jeremiah 50, I just want to look at the first three verses. The word which the Lord spoke concerning Babylon, the land of the Chaldeans, through Jeremiah the prophet, Declare and proclaim among the nations. Proclaim it and lift up a standard. Do not conceal it, but say, Babylon has been captured. Bel has been put to shame. Marduk has been shattered. Her images have been put to shame. Her idols have been shattered. For a nation has come up against her out of the north. And it will make her land an object of horror. And there will be no inhabitant in it. Both man and beast have wandered off. They have gone away. The Medes and Persians are coming from the north. Go to chapter 51. Listen to the description. Chapter 51, verse 36. Chapter 51 of Jeremiah, verse 36. I mean, in your own time, if you just read all of these chapters, they're very amazing, but I'm just cherry-picking some of the more interesting parts for our text. Therefore, verse 36, thus says the Lord, behold, I'm going to plead your case, this is Jerusalem's case, and exact full vengeance for you. And I will dry up her, this is talking about Babylon, I will dry up her broad river and make her fountain dry. Babylon will become a heap of ruins, a haunt of jackals, an object of horror, and hissing without inhabitants. They will roar together like young lions. They will howl like lions and cubs. When they become heated up, I will serve them their banquet and make them drunk, that they may become jubilant and may sleep a perpetual sleep and not wake up, declares the Lord. Listen to one more section before we conclude today. Look at verse 57 and 58 of Jeremiah 51. The Lord says, speaking of Babylon, I will make her princes and her wise men drunk, her governors, her prefects, and her mighty men, that they may sleep a perpetual sleep and not wake up, declares the king whose name is the Lord of armies. Thus says the Lord of armies, the broad wall of Babylon will be completely razed, and her high gates will be set on fire, so the peoples will toil for nothing, and the nations become exhausted only for fire. Now, go ahead and turn back to Daniel 5 while I tell you what happened from some ancient texts. So, the Persians were outside the city, and Cyrus is a brilliant military strategist. Okay, and what he does to get in the city is he diverts the channel of the Euphrates River. He diverts the channel so that by the wall, the water will lower and so that he can get his soldiers to go in under the wall. But that's not enough because they have, you know, they're not just buttressing their walls only against the Euphrates. They have another wall. So it's kind of like a two-sectioned wall, right? So the soldiers, some of Cyrus's soldiers come in under that wall. They're splashing around. The men who are standing guard that night while there's this drunken party going on hear the splashing, according to historical accounts, look over, see people in the water, and think that guests have fallen drunkenly over the wall. So they open the gate to let these guys in. They kill the guards and open the gates, and Cyrus's army is just able to march in by surprise and take the city instantly. Not only that, Josephus records that Cyrus took Babylon and afterwards gave orders to raise the outer walls of the city because it presented a very redoubtable and formidable appearance. He says, we better burn this thing down before anybody gets an idea because we're not staying here. We're moving. Okay, we don't want them to revolt against us, right? The water is diverted. The enemies come in, take it in a single night while the people are in a drunken party, and then they burn the walls. It's Isaiah's prophecy. By word. So notice how it ends. Verse 29. Then Belshazzar gave orders, and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a necklace of gold around his neck. He's probably thinking, don't do this. And issued a proclamation concerning him that he now had authority as third ruler in the kingdom. That same night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain. So Darius the Mede received the kingdom at about the age of 62. On October 12th, 539 B.C., the party ends for Belshazzar. He's weighed. He's found deficient. Well, on September 27th, 2017, at the age of 91, the party ended for Hugh Hefner. Before his death, Hugh Hefner had planned for a cremation and for his ashes to be interred at Westwood Memorial Park in Los Angeles in the crypt beside Marilyn Monroe, which he purchased for $75,000. And in Hefner's words, spending eternity next to Marilyn is an opportunity too sweet to pass up. Now, unfortunately for him, I think he was mistaken about a couple things. One, he's not going to spend eternity in a mausoleum next to Marilyn Monroe. You know, his body is going to rot away, but that's not where he's at. And I think the second thing that he made a huge mistake on, and this is not because he's worse than any of us, not because his sin is any greater than any of our sins, but I think that he thought, his problem was he thought he could secure an eternal rest. He thought that securing that is something he can afford. I can make it. I can buy it. I'm okay. That's the difference. We are all weighed and found deficient. And Christ is going to make it clear when he comes on the scene to Israel. Sermon on the Mount. Okay? He says, look, you are to be perfect as the Father is perfect. Does anybody hear that? Nope. You know, you're either 100% or you're deficient. We all have that problem. The difference is we got to recognize how we can become, how we can be weighed, how we can be acceptable before the Lord. And it's only through Christ. You seek, you find. You ask, you receive. You knock, it is open to you. That's the Christian hope. He paid it all. That little children's song. Jesus paid it all. All to him I owe. Sin had left a crimson stain. He washed it white as snow. He is the only one who has weighed and met the mark. And the only question we have is, do we know him? Do we know him?